globally, we still tend to underestimate the cascading system risks. And if major ocean circulation systems destabilize, food security becomes a geopolitical issue very quickly.
A very big welcome to this episode of Front Footing the Future. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and I'll be your host for interviewing about 20 experts ahead of the New Zealand general election and exploring how we can make our climate policy fit for purpose. This isn't the first time today's guest, Simon Miller, has joined us on Climate Matters. Simon is the Executive Director of green business organisation Pure Advantage, a role that's seen him being central to their great series on regenerative agriculture and to the inspirational forestry and renewal initiatives from Otatau Nahiri through to Recloaking Papatūānuku and last year's terrific film Thinking Like a Forest. It's wonderful to welcome you back, Simon. And as always, I'm greatly looking forward to our conversation.
Kia ora, Lindsay, and to your audience here. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
I'd like to start, Simon, by taking what might seem a sideways step. I know you were recently at the Agriculture and Climate Change Conference, but I didn't make it along this time. For listeners that don't recall my reports on prior conferences, it's run most years by the New Zealand Ag Research Centre, and I see this year's conference was under the banner Unlocking Our Low Emissions Advantage.
I thought it was a really well-produced conference. It was punctuated by the start of each session by lowing cattle, which was hilarious. And so if you didn't go back into the session, you know, the moos got louder and louder and louder and deeper, and you know, you just couldn't stand around having a cup of tea anymore. You had to go back into the session. Yeah, and a really good MC and Eloise Gibson. But the conference reflects a sector that increasingly understands how climate and nature are no longer peripheral issues, and they're becoming core economic and strategic issues for New Zealand ag. There is still tension around the phrase low emissions advantage, because biologically we're a high emissions agricultural economy, and particularly on methane. But the opportunity is real if New Zealand moves, you know, faster than competitors toward genuinely lower emissions and more nature positive production systems. But for that, they weren't talking about reductions and removals as much as they might have been, I thought, when you attended the conference a couple of years ago. It was very a tech heavy conference. And there's but there is a shift from, we used to find, or I used to find, a bit more defensive conversations toward, you know, practical transition discussions. But now they do talk about resilience and market access and farm system redesign, land use optimization, methane tools, and integrating forestry and biodiversity. But there's a growing recognition that New Zealand's future advantage probably won't come from volume alone, but from high integrity production linked to environmental performance and trusted provenance. But with that high integrity comes more cost. Real highlights for me, just to top off them, were Melissa Clark Reynolds was amazing, talking about the future of food and AI. Alex Hillary, Sir Edmund Hillary's grandson, was amazing.
Okay.
Very inspirational at the end of day one about leadership. And a young a businessman named Oliver Hunt talking about MedSolve, I think, is his company, and you know, recyclables or reusables inside the medical sector. But I thought those were really inspirational programming. But and the core part of the conference was that New Zealand Ag isn't short of sort of biogenic methane reducing technologies, but they won't be used unless the farmers actually decide to adopt them, and moreover, the public. And there was a big reference there to the UK's Bovaer methane inhibitor trials on several farms, which ultimately ended up going belly up. A large degree of skepticism there. I thought a highlight was Cameron Bagri, who was quite confronting, rightly confronting, saying New Zealand needs to take the long-term view as it tries to manage climate change in a world riveted by immediate crises. And one of his quotes was that what you get when you've got a clash between cyclical forces by inflation and structural imperatives, you've got an economic recipe for fracturing populism and division. So he was sort of suggesting that we're going to be in a high inflationary period for quite some time, and echoing the fracturing of systems as we know it. A large part of the rhetoric at the conference was that technological solutions will save the day. And Minister Macleay came there and, of course, ruled out any on-farm emissions pricing and was betting big on, their tech with, I think they've invested $400 million in the Ag Emissions Centre. He announced a sort of a couple of initiatives like early adoption accelerator scheme, and then something called Cool Sheep Program, so to boost low emission sheep genetics. So it's all on in terms of technology, and it's almost like business as usual with tech.
Can I just interject there? I'm mindful that you have quite a background in exploring regenerative agriculture, not as a person doing it, but in terms of, for example, podcast series you've done and things like that. Did you feel that there was much interest in the conference or much expressed in terms of finding lower impact ways of actually farming on the land? Or was it mainly, as you just said, business as usual, but with more tech?
Yeah, I thought there was a couple of conversations where it was touched on, but nothing in a substantive way. Regenerative ag, organics, that sort of stuff. I mean, you really have to get big ag to get behind that to support it, I think. But yeah, disappointingly, no. And as I said at the start of that little response, the reductions and removals are not ultimately hand in hand right now. I would have liked to have heard them talk a lot more about what we advocate, which is integration of mosaic pattern of land use, weaving native forests and wetlands back into the farming system. But yes, getting rewarded for that. And in fact, there was a if farmers are going to be incentivized to deploy these technologies, they should also be incentivized to deploy working more closely with nature and creating resilience in the landscapes for all of those benefits.
At beginning of this week, actually, the government announced its endorsement of certain voluntary carbon and nature markets that could include, and I'm quoting, restoring wetlands, planting native trees, and protecting habitats, which in a way I think has some kinship with recloaking Papatūānuku, which we'll come to talk about. But does that tie in with what you were just saying about the sense you got at the conference that they focus on tech, but they don't seem to be doing incentives to move into that area? Is that Am I misreading the signals from the government there?
A slew of like government announcements. I guess this week too, there was the tort reform piece that came out, for basically government taking back their responsibility on climate change, which is quite ironic considering they haven't been doing that. That's the Mike Smith case and the corporate mafia that's going on. The
Totally.
Conservation Amendment Act is another one that's coming. It basically it is and with the plans to endorse nature and carbon credit schemes, under the different provisos, particularly the Paris Agreement. It's basically sh shifting the government responsibility to, on public lands to the market. And I think that's where we're getting into tricky space in New Zealand, actually, right now. So, but the announcement, I guess, is it's potentially important because it recognises that restoring nature at a meaningful scale will require private capital alongside public funding, and that is what RP or Reclaiming Papatūānuku what was set up on. But one of the key issues now becomes integrity again because it was undermined previously in the voluntary carbon sector, and so now there's the value is in creating this integrity, but with integrity comes a lot more cost. And then I guess one of the lessons we have from the ETS is that markets can create unintended land use outcomes if the incentives are too narrow or poorly designed. I guess rewarding genuine long-term ecological restoration, like wetlands, indigenous systems, catchment resilience, rather than simply the cheapest carbon outcome. But what I'm finding is that even with the RP 2.0 phase, it's very carbon heavy. Like, it's what's the carbon price we can get for the mitigation or the removals that we're going to achieve, you know, and because carbon's worth 60 and biodiversity is worth a dollar. Yeah, but in many ways, I guess the announcement on nature markets does align, well, it does fully align with where RP discussions have been heading, moving from the vision to a credible delivery framework and financing mechanisms and implementation pathways.
So maybe a step in the right direction, but not a silver bullet.
That's right. I mean, just to sort of pivot to the RP conversation that you mentioned, I mean,
Recloaking Puppet to Enugu is what Simon's referring to with RP. Sorry, carry on, Simon.
so recloaking Papatūānuku, as Lindsay mentioned in the, as you mentioned in the opening, it was it's about taking action now for the benefit of future generations. It's an ambitious environmental initiative to restore and enhance more than 2 million hectares of New Zealand's indigenous landscapes and forests and wetlands over the next 30 years. And it was born from the growing frequency of the extreme weather events, particularly at that time, 2023, Cyclone Gabrielle, Cyclone Hale, the Auckland floods, and we've had multiple more since then. And it offers solutions to our climate and biodiversity crisis. It isn't just simply a tree planting program. It's a proposal. It's really a landscape resilience strategy.
Can you just amplify on what you mean by landscape resilience? I'm asking that because I got asked it the other day. I used that term and they said, "What do you mean by landscape scale?"
Professor David Norton, who's our chief science advisor, and he is actually one of the core architects of RP in the sense that he really came up with the ambitious initiative at the time to restore 5 million hectares in 5 years. Like, but that was what it was put out. But once we when we sort of navigated the costing of that initially with McKinsey, it was outlandish. It was going to be, you know, $80 billion. So David has proposed the landscape resilience being using catchment logic, eco-spatially relevant to identify systems that regulate water, stabilize slopes from erosion, improving biodiversity while also supporting carbon sequestration as well. So, you know, reducing soil erosion and improving the water quality, slowing the flow of the water through those catchments so it stays further up in the catchment and it gets, you know, absorbed by the deep rooting, diverse native forests. And you see that in Think Like a Forest, the film, where you see Graham Atkins showing examples of the moss that used to cover the forests and it's like it acts like a sponge.
Incredible. So the incredible scene of him, isn't it? Squashing it like a huge soft cushion. Thanks, Simon. That's a great answer. And I rather deflected you when, with the question on landscape scale, but you've done a good job with that. There was the more you wanted to say on that recloaking puppet to Enugu.
I was just going to touch on, so when we introduced it, the receiving environment or the political environment at the time was basically that we would rely on New Zealand's commitments under the Paris Agreement, and it assumed the government would fund a majority of the delivery costs for counting emissions reductions against the country's nationally determined contributions. But that environment has changed. You know, the government has signaled previously that it's no longer a priority to do that, and that large scale offshore credit purchase is unlikely. So that's why, you know, the shift has been how can we fund this through the market, the private market, and also with catalytic philanthropic investment.
Just dialing back briefly to the Ag and Climate Conference, Simon, I was just interested to know whether there was any talk about some of the big global climate systems and things going on. For example, there's a lot of talk at the moment about a super El Niño coming. And there's also those of us that delve into the climate science a bit, discover things like the breakdown of the giant ocean circulation systems, which potentially should have us all breaking out in a cold sweat. Was there any discussion at the conference of those sort of mega events and what they might mean for our New Zealand Incorporated?
Well, I'd love you to actually pronounce the acronym AMOC, because like the words within that are actually quite hard to pronounce, aren't they? Like
Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. How does that sound?
Like what kind of, that's an amazing definition of an acronym, isn't it? But AMOC sounds great. Absolutely none that I can recall. And sort of, I guess what concerns me, and I think Cameron Baggery really brought this to light too, is that globally, we still tend to underestimate the cascading system risks. And if major ocean circulation systems destabilize, or major breadbasket regions are disrupted simultaneously, food security becomes a geopolitical issue very quickly. That actually reinforces the importance of resilience thinking and healthy soils and water retention and catchment restoration and diversified landscapes and reducing those vulnerability to risks. And that's why we have continually framed restoration as infrastructure, not simply conservation.
Can you just repeat that? I hadn't heard that phrase and it sounded really good.
So RP has always really been about framing restoration as infrastructure or ecological infrastructure, and not simply conservation. I think what the government has presented in terms of its bills this week, the Conservation Amendment Act and the nature markets, I mean, it's really, and historically how New Zealand's looked at over there as conservation and over here as, you know, dairy cows. And that's not how, just like the molecule of carbon dioxide is agnostic in terms of where it is, so too is, you know, is ecology. You know, like it's thrive where we want it to thrive. It thrives where it's supposed to thrive, you know, within the system of ecology. And if it doesn't, it breaks down.
This series, which I've termed Front Footing the Future, Getting Our Climate Policy Fit for Purpose, means that I do want to steer into the climate policy space a bit. The ag and forestry sectors are huge players in New Zealand's climate change context. Methane from livestock, as I'm sure you're aware, produces about 43% of our total greenhouse gas emissions. And carbon forestry is at the heart of the emissions trading scheme. You touched on that a minute ago. Policy settings in these sectors at present, Simon, and where do they seem to be heading? And for an ambitious reduction of emissions, where do you feel they should be heading?
I'll just, for the record, I'm not a policy expert. New Zealand's policy settings in terms of climate are regressionary. There's just no question. The repeals that have happened since this current coalition government has been in place have been staggering. They've been flooding the sector with, you know, announcements that needing, you know, submissions and commentaries. People are just, you know, exhausted. It's not, you know, the people being the other ENGOs like EDS and who regularly, like in Motu, who definitely, you know, reply to these submissions. But I guess optimistically, we're, and I guess we would hope, because a lot of these people have grandchildren and you'd think that they're thinking like this, but we're trying to reconcile three things simultaneously, reducing emissions and repairing degraded ecological systems. The risk is that we continue to treat these as competing objectives rather than interconnected ones. And that's, you know, I think that's still happening in the New Zealand political environment. The ETS obviously accelerated large-scale exotic forestry because carbon became the dominant economic signal.
Yes, yeah.
But the next phase should be more nuanced policy settings that better distinguish between short-term carbon accounting and long-term landscape resilience. And it's shifting that the benefit model, I guess, to value what the long-term objectives are. And if I had sort of a magic wand, I guess policy should support integrated land use systems. So productive farming where appropriate, permanent indigenous native forest cover and wetlands where appropriate, and using the catchment scale planning and logic rather than, isolated decisions. And that's where it goes back to resilience. And I think David, Professor Norton talks about that a lot. And if you think about active catchment groups, there's many of them around the country, some 300. There's a really active Ātaahuatanga New Zealand catchment community. Waimata catchment and Tarawhiti is super well organized. They've got a plan for their restoration. I mean, that's what we should be investing in and encouraging, and looking for financial models that reflect the benefits that those participants or those stakeholders have in those communities.
I mean, I've got someone who's been on this show a couple of years ago, Olivia Hyatt. She's got a PhD in climate and geology, I think it is. And but she's working in a farming community in Tasman and very much involved with catchment studies and restoration and so on. And when you think how the Tasman region got nailed by a double whammy in the middle of last winter, you can't escape the benefits of that sort of whole catchment thinking, really, can you?
That one was with all that massive wind throw, wasn't there, across some of those exotic farmers?
Huge,
Now, I understand that a large part of the impact of the floods there were to do with the braided river systems. It's still about how we, working with managing the land, but that wasn't all about like clear fell forestry impacts.
I want to shift now to the question of changing patterns of farming, Simon, and this may or may not link back to the Ag and Climate Conference, but you rub up against a whole lot of thought leaders in the space and trying to steer the course between profitable farming and climate responsible food production. Are you picking up any signals about how our food production systems might be changing, where we're at or should be heading, and what policy settings are needed, do you think, to incentivize the necessary change? Now, you have talked a little bit about that before, but particularly in terms of diversifying our agricultural base.
When we did our regenerative future, which is now, gosh, 6 years ago,
I remember that,
we really lifted the lid on that discussion. I think that was catalyzed a little bit by COVID. We were now at home. Essential workers, of course, were farmers. And we also looked more closely at where our food was coming from. We were able to bake sourdough. We were able to look at our garden. There was a lot of sort of inspirational. We could see kōwhai in the right up to the road in the harbour at the Waitematā in Auckland, where I was living at the time. So there was a lot of, oh, we can do this better, right? We can, and I think our regenerative future was timely, and we really highlighted a lot of farmers around New Zealand who are really active in pursuing that. And as we sort of found out, most or all farmers believe that they farm regeneratively to some extent. But I think my observations are, and with Reclaiming Papatuānuku, RP, farmers are increasingly understand that the future isn't simply about just producing more, it's about producing differently and more intelligently. There's growing interest in diversified farm systems, from integrated forestry, lower input models, soil health, water resilience, and that environmental credibility, as well as electrification of their farm systems. And I we think that the best farmers are increasingly thinking at whole landscape scale. And I guess what's interesting is that many of the shifts are being driven not just by regulation, but by market signals, perhaps insurance pressures, investor expectations, and even intergenerational thinking. When policy certainty remains high and it's still no clear pathway for New Zealand ag to be accounting for emissions other than technological, that's why these long-term signals matter. The farmers that we've met for recloaking and through Think Like a Forest, they and the catchment groups that, like Professor Norton, again, I keep mentioning him, but he is just an amazing participant in this recloaking initiative. He's met many catchment groups around the country and farmers, and all of these farmers want Recloaking Papatoa. They want to have more native forests on their
Right.
landscapes. They just want to have a little bit of help to get it done, and then the work will happen. So.
Very interesting. And if I can just pick up a little bit on two things. I remember back in your regenerative ag series, several, well, I won't say several, but there were farmers in there which were demonstrating they could achieve really good productivity with a lot fewer inputs and often lower stock levels. And I don't know whether George Moss was at the conference this time, but I've met him a couple of times from Tokoroa Farms, and he's got fantastic data that shows that he's lowered his synthetic inputs, he's lowered his stock level, he's increased his milk solids output, and if those things, they're not about just about lowering emissions, they're actually about actually running a more profitable farm. And I'm wondering, I'm surprised that there hasn't been more traction on that, although I have heard not from George Moss, a farmer saying, well, actually, when I got to this point, I suddenly find that the fertilizer company stopped bothering to try and sell stuff to me. They weren't interested in just a small, or someone who was a very small customer.
I haven't, with my focus on recloaking for the last couple of years, I haven't looked into the work that groups like Quorum Sense and farmers like Sam Lang and Sam Hogg. In fact, I wrote a chapter in the Kiwis and Climate book, and Sam Hogg wrote a chapter there with Sam Lang, and that's an extraordinary story. Here's a guy who did a law degree, went back to the family farm. And they totally redid it after generations on that old system, and he's got profitable, and that's a story that I think can be told and retold and shared. Farmers like Hamish Bielsky and Simon Osborne, they were on this path, a bunch of years ago. So it's just, and I guess you got to go, what is the demand of agricultural output, unless it's sort of bespoke sort of premium, it's generally being siphoned off into large scale consumption or alternative, like feedstocks, for the very cattle that we end up eating. So it's just some weird big systems in there that are hard to reframe, working more closely with nature when they have such large inputs. But that said, I think the dairy farms in places like the US, they're on concrete pads, a lot of them, so they can basically contain their emissions, if that's the most important thing,
I'd like to move from here, Simon, into food, because agriculture is about producing food, and we all know that food waste is actually a really big deal in terms of emissions. It's up to 10% of global warming, which is a big deal, and encompasses the emissions come from everything from food that's wasted at the front end because it gets rejected or spoiled during production or in transport or even in storage, right through to the consumer end, where supermarkets and kitchens discard disfigured or outdated or leftover food. However, we don't seem to be making big inroads into reducing this, except maybe in a modest way for local food rescue schemes, such as I know the one in Nelson called Thai Rescue, which redistributes discarded edible food that comes from supermarkets and the like. Are you aware of any initiatives to tackle food waste at large scale? Be it through changing farming produce or practices. Or I know in France, for example, a few years ago, they outlawed large retailers from discarding edible food to waste.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I guess food waste is one of the least discussed but most solvable climate issues. And what's extraordinary is that we simultaneously waste enormous quantities of food while worrying about future food insecurity and emissions. It's like, well, let's go back to the source and look at this. But there's a group called, and I'm on the board of Wastebusters in Wanaka, which has a broad remit around circular economy and waste reuse, recycling, and repurpose. But they have been part of an organization called EveryBite, which is a community-led support program to support households with skills so they can eat all the kai they buy and grow, and prevent food waste rather than trying to deal with it once it happens. So it's actually running during now, that during this month, Food Waste Awareness Month. So programs are running at the moment. I think there's 12 hubs around the country, and it's a joint program from Zero Waste Aotearoa and Environment Hubs Aotearoa. So the first 3 years have been funded by the Ministry for the Environment, and Wastebusters in Wānaka helped design the program in 2023. There's four foundation hubs, and they also support the other hubs to tweak the program and suit their communities. So, for example, the team in Wānaka, Queenstown, have delivered in partnership with local chefs, and it's been pretty popular and successful, apparently. It's a nationwide program delivered by local grassroots community groups who make it authentic to their community. So, yeah, it's like designed to be a fun experience. Celebrating kai and swapping tips and tricks, as well as understanding why your own household wastes food. Like, why does it? I mean, no one plans to waste food, so it's about understanding why plans go off track, and then having some hacks to overcome those situations. So, in terms of scale of that, the target's to work with communities across New Zealand to reduce food waste by 10%. And it's a I guess a very high proportion of households that do. Every bite report a change. So,
I love initiatives that give people some agency in what they do, and that sounds like a classic case where it's empowering people to take maybe modest steps, but still could collectively have quite a big impact.
our food systems optimize for uniformity and efficiency, don't they? Rather than
Than they ever.
Value retention.
You just have to go to the supermarket. I'm someone that likes to buy small tomatoes because I live on my own. But I go to the supermarket and they're all the size of apples almost, you know, and if and that's the uniformity thing coming through, isn't it? All exactly the same color.
I thought
Well,
you'd be going to the farmers market in Nelson.
I do go there sometimes. I love going to the farmers market. In fact, I prefer that and I'm prepared to pay a price premium for it. But I don't get everything there. Yeah. It's a good market too, as I expect you know. Well, look, Simon, we're drawing to a close here, but before we do finally shut up shop, is there anything else that you'd like to add in that I should have asked you that I didn't, or that you're burning a hole in your brain? Maybe there's not. I don't know.
Well, look, I, in light of the current situation with the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine, and this endless, media coverage on anything that Trump does, who's just totally destroying the world. I think I just think that we need to vote out everyone who's in power right now, and we need to vote for people that are aligned to, a climate resilient future, really. I mean, climate impacts underpin everything, and they're impacting, as you mentioned, the AMOCs, the ocean currents, the jet streams, they're impacting, atmospheric rivers, storm frequencies, food supply lines. Communities, and a lot of the war stuff is driven by access to energy resources, the status quo, and I just think that as a society, we need to make the change. We need to, as Gandhi always says, be the change we want to be. And I think that's where we're at. We're heading into a crisis moment, I think, and we need to be resilient within that and be prepared for those changes. I don't think our current government has, I don't know whether they don't understand, or they're not forewarning us enough, or they're just hoping it all passes us by and it's back to having your second house in a boat and we're all good. It's not. I think we're in a massive restructural change, and our society needs to be informed about that and prepared to be resilient in the face of that.
Simon, I had no idea what you were going to say. I wouldn't have guessed that, but that's terrific. And you'd be interested to know that the first interview in this series, the Front Footing the Future series, is with Professor Jonathan Boston. And it we're recording this on the 14th of May, and his comes out on the 18th, I think it is. One of his statements was, "We need leaders to be truthful about what's happening with the climate." I'm totally with you on what you say, and it's so important. And I'm not one that normally pushes a particular party, but I can't help feeling that this might be the time when the Opportunity Party finds it gets its toe in the door, and I wouldn't be averse to that, to be honest. They bring some fresh thinking, but we'll see where we get to.
Well, it's across the board. It's just, it's just so hard with the current global situation, isn't it? It's just like,
It's brutal.
as my partner, she likes to tell me that it's mostly, if not all, men who are screwing it up and need more women leaders in there, probably bringing some empathy.
I'm totally with her on that. I think the best hope for the future are bright young women, to be quite honest. Certainly not us old men. Or not us, I mean me, old man. You're not an old man. On that philosophical note, maybe we have to draw this to a close. Thank you so much for joining us again. I've really enjoyed it, and it's a privilege to get your insights into the areas we've been covering.
Thanks, Lindsay. A real pleasure to be here.
I'm so enjoying the variety of guests we have on this Front Footing the Future interview series, and Simon has added to that mix again with his special insights. Thank you so much, Simon. Now, to give you a heads up on who's coming next, next week we have Shamabeel Yacob, very well known economist, financial analyst, and a commentator that's often on TVNZ or Radio New Zealand when there's a budget or whatever. Following that will be Mirjana Stevens. We've had Mirjana on the show before. She is a director of Whakatu Incorporation. That's the Maori organization across the top of the South Island. We'll be discussing the interface between Matarangi Maori and the climate crisis. So I do hope I have your company again for those episodes. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.